From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Caudette, and this is Idaho Matters. Approximately half of all Americans will go through menopause. However, it is still an under-discussed topic, leaving many women scared and uninformed about the changes they're experiencing and in the dark when it comes to perimenopause symptoms, think hot flashes and night sweats, and hormone therapy. So today, we're spending the next hour talking about this topic with three experts in the field. Joining us today are Jill Gustafson, a certified nurse midwife and menopause specialist with a private practice here in Idaho. It's called Quantum Women's Health. Dr. Paru David, an internist and women's health specialist at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona. She is a menopause certified practitioner by the North American Menopause Society, as well as Dr. Tally Sobel, a women's health internist at Mayo Clinic in Arizona. She is also a certified menopause practitioner by the North American Menopause Society. I want to welcome all three of you to the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Gemma.
So, Jill, I want to start the conversation today with you because I've been thinking quite a bit about this topic for quite some time. And one thing that sticks out to me is that, you know, we all get the talk when we are about to start our periods or once we've started our periods. There's no talk that we get, though, when we're getting to the end of our periods. And why do you think that the topic of menopause is not just so often missed, but it's misunderstood and therefore there is misinformation around it?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Gemma. I really appreciate your perspective. I feel like this is kind of the talk we're going to have today.
Yeah.
The talk. And sometimes it does feel like that. And, you know, in the clinic, just speaking with women and sort of, you know, watching, you know, them awaken to this topic, it's actually really gratifying. So, you know, I think it's a topic that gets missed, you know, mainly because, I mean, for me, it goes back to the fact that medicine was essentially founded by males, and that it's relatively newer that women are really in medicine and are actually, you know, in some ways, there are more females in medicine than males in a lot of specialties now. But if you really think about it, you know, we just haven't been getting the right messaging for a long time about how significant this transition is, not just for the temporary years around menopause, but for what it means for the rest of our lives.
So let's differentiate between certain, I guess, I don't know if we want to call them stages of this, Jill, but can you tell us the difference between early perimenopause, but then there's perimenopause, and then there's menopause?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, you know, everyone who's born with ovaries is going to go through menopause at some point. And just for context, you know, we spend about almost half of our lives in menopause if we're lucky. So the, you know, we start with what's the average age when periods stop. When periods stop, you enter into menopause. So the time leading up to when periods stop is called perimenopause. And the time when periods stop and then everything after that is called menopause. And so the average age of menopause is 51 in the United States. And typically, women start noticing gradual shift in their hormones about 8 to 10 years before the last period. So usually around age 40 to 45 on average would be what I like to call very early perimenopause, where you start to notice subtle shifts. And then when the shifts become more noticeable because they're becoming more dramatic, the changes in estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone get more dramatic as you get closer to the final period. And that would be what we typically think of as perimenopause, the average age around 45 to 48. And some women may start their transition earlier and some women may start their transition later. And then I think it also is helpful to keep in mind that some women may have to have their ovaries removed surgically at some point in their life and will therefore go into menopause within days of that surgery. So the potential for it is really there, and everyone should really expect this to happen at some point in their life.
Okay. So I want to bring Dr. David, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. As Jill mentioned, symptoms of perimenopause can last between 8 to 10 years. And I tell you, I was blown away by that when I found that out, because I think that's something that, again, most women don't know that it could last that long. With that said, though, can you talk to us about some of the symptoms that can often end up being debilitating for women? I'm thinking of things like brain fog, but even depression.
Absolutely. So, you know, first I just wanted to mention that, you know, for many years, you know, talking about menopause was kind of a taboo topic. And so many of my patients will tell me that they never discussed it, even with their own mothers. And now we're beginning to become more comfortable in discussing this topic. And you're right. You know, the beginning of perimenopause can kind of sneak up on people. And in the beginning, patients will say, you know, I'm just maybe not sleeping as much at night, or maybe, you know, PMS is a little bit worse. But, you know, as Jill said, as we go further into perimenopause, you know, many changes start occurring, especially with periods. You know, sometimes patients will begin to have the symptoms of vasomotor symptoms, such as hot flashes and night sweats. And then definitely once your periods stop, some of those symptoms, you know, continue. And about 75 to 80% of women will continue to have problematic hot flashes and night sweats in menopause. And so it is definitely something that needs to be addressed. And I think that the other thing that occurs during this time, I mean, it's a tumultuous time for many women. You know, we are in the sandwich generation. So, you know, we may be taking care of kids at home. We may be caring for our aging parents. You know, for many women, their career is at a peak. And then suddenly, you know, they're having lots of physical and emotional symptoms that are occurring around menopause. And so what we know is that with the vasomotor symptoms, the hot flashes, the night sweats, many women have disruptive sleep. They just are not sleeping well at night. And that lack of sleep can lead to many symptoms, including cognitive fog, even mood disturbance like depression. And then it can definitely affect your health. You know, the lack of sleep, as we know, can lead to more obesity, more cardiovascular risk. And then the lack of estrogen itself is an increased risk for cardiovascular disease, and also a change in metabolic health. We know that diabetes can increase with the lack of estrogen. So there's lots of changes that are occurring at this time in our lives.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Sobel, these symptoms that Dr. David just mentioned can also, I think, impact some women's mental health. I mean, as we talked, we mentioned depression, but can you explain a bit more about, I mean, how this really does impact not just your physical health, but your mental health?
Yes, thank you, Gemma. So we know that perimenopause and menopause, it's a time of vulnerability for women where anxiety, depression can really heighten. So women come to us often saying they're more irritable, they feel more weepy, they're just kind of noticing these big mood shifts. Now, what we know is that during this time, there are huge fluctuations in hormone levels, and oftentimes that can contribute to mood. But as Dr. David said, these women are having debilitating quality of life symptoms, especially with these hot flashes, night sweats, poor sleep. And this can really impact mood. So not only do we see mood changes in women with history of depression or anxiety, but for many women, it's even a new kind of onset of these symptoms. So they notice this because they're just it's impacting them at work, it's impacting their family lives. And from a day-to-day perspective, it can be really difficult for these women.
Mm-hmm. So Jill, I want to talk about treatment for all of these symptoms, because there are some temporary treatments like hormone replacement therapy that can reduce, you know, symptoms, right? So can you, and we'll get deeper into a hormone therapy in the next segment, but I quickly want to just touch on that, about the fact that you don't have to sit here and suffer with all of these symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think sometimes you have to look at what's the cost of not doing anything, especially if this can go on for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, where you're the cumulative effect of all of the things that we just mentioned. And so, and then there's, as we're going to kind of hopefully get more deeper into that there's actually benefits to hormone replacement therapy on its own. But I think too, there's so many key and critical lifestyle pieces that we talk about, really helping women, feel a sense of empowerment and control just with themselves. So focusing on stress management, healthy diet, lots of exercise, really trying to address sleep, and just getting quality nutrients on board, I think is a huge shift, especially as Dr. David was saying that, we are the sandwich generation, and we are multitasking, and we are not prioritizing ourselves. So a lot of times the treatment conversation kind of comes back to, okay, what's your biggest issue? Is it hot flashes? Is it depression? Is it bone muscle pain? Is it heart palpitations? Is it anxiety? And then what do we recommend? And what do we know, from the research that is going to be the most beneficial for that?
So there is so much misinformation around hormone replacement therapy. And I think in so many ways, this has done a disservice for women. So Dr. David, can we start this next part of the conversation by just talking about the myths of HRT versus the actual risks of HRT?
Absolutely, Jenna. Yes, so when I see patients for a menopause consult, the first thing that I do with my patients is, I want to find out, what sort of symptoms are they having and how much it's affecting their lives, and what is their quality of life. Once I assess that, I like to hear from patients to find out, well, where are they coming from? I'd like to hear their perspective, because you're right. There have been so many myths out there regarding hormone therapy. And so understanding where they're coming from is key, and then helping to dispel some of those myths. One of the most common things that I hear from patients is that, oh no, I am not going on hormones because it's going to increase my risk of breast cancer. And I think that we really need to put that into perspective for patients. That's probably their biggest concern. And so most of our data comes from a study called the Women's Health Initiative, which is actually almost 2 decades old now. And it really gave us a lot of good information regarding the benefits and risks of hormone therapy. It was the first large national prospective trial that was done in the United States, because prior to that, it was mostly observational. And what they found from that was that there was a slight increased risk of breast cancer. But when you broke it down into the numbers, it was really 1 in 1,000 patients who go on hormone therapy, or 9 in 10,000 women who go on hormone therapy. So it is a relatively small number. And then you also have to take into consideration, multiple things, the patient's family history, what is their breast density like based on their mammogram? Do they have other risk factors? And I take all of that information and really synthesize it for my patients to really give them an appropriate risk for developing breast cancer if they go on hormone therapy. And so some of the benefits that we know of hormone therapy, of course, we know that it helps with problematic hot flashes and night sweats, but it also is really beneficial for our bones. And that is the other indication for hormone therapy. So if you have a patient who has bone loss, such as osteopenia, you can give a patient hormone therapy to help prevent osteoporosis. It's not indicated for the treatment of osteoporosis, but it definitely can help prevent it.
Okay, so Dr. David, this might be a really dumb question, but I get confused about what hormone therapy actually is. In the sense of like, okay, I know that our estrogen levels drop, testosterone, progesterone, but like what is hormone replacement therapy actually?
Right. So when we talk about hormone replacement therapy, we're really giving back certain hormones that help patients' symptoms. And we also know that the hormones itself can help in other ways, just like I said, with bone health. But, you know, we also know, and these are not indications for hormone therapy, but it's kind of like, oh, well, by the way, it's also going to help in this way, is that, you know, if you have a patient who is at a higher risk for developing diabetes, if they go on hormone therapy, which is the estrogen, they will actually have a reduced risk of developing diabetes. And the same thing for fatty liver disease, which is another big disease that's, you know, occurring in the United States. That's a byproduct of obesity. So it's the estrogen that really is the one that gives most of the benefits to us. For women who have an intact uterus, or people who have an intact uterus, you have to use progesterone, and that's to prevent the risk for endometrial cancer or uterine cancer. So a lot of times for women, both of those hormones are given together. Now, our ovaries do produce testosterone. I know you asked about that a second ago. Mm-hmm. And, that's a big question that a lot of patients ask. And that's a little bit controversial. Testosterone is not FDA approved, whereas estrogen and progesterone is FDA approved for the treatment of any symptoms. And so I really have a longer discussion about the need and for testosterone and if it's really necessary.
Okay. But I mean, but the two are, I mean, estrogen and progesterone are really, when we talk about hormone replacement therapy, those are the two.
Correct.
Okay. So, Jill, you mentioned this in the last segment about some women, needing to get their ovaries removed, sometimes getting a hysterectomy, getting your uterus removed. So is there a difference in natural versus surgical menopause and how it's treated?
So I think there can be a difference with surgical menopause. You may not have been perimenopausal at all before that. And so it can be quite an abrupt transition. And generally speaking, women who have surgical menopause have a rapid onset of menopause symptoms, and they can be more severe and sometimes last longer. But also nowadays, it's more likely for physicians to prescribe hormone therapy right from the start of their post-operative recovery, because we know that women who have, especially if they're younger than the age of natural menopause, which is 51, that if they're younger than 51, it is most medical societies recommend hormone replacement therapy for the preventative health benefits, such as reduction in cardiovascular disease and mortality. As Dr. David said, a reduction in the risk for diabetes, reduction in risk for colon cancer and osteoporosis. So the younger that you are at the age of menopause, the longer that you have essentially with no more estrogen in your body, the more at risk you are for those specific things. And so surgical menopause may be more promptly treated is what I'm trying to say, but it can be more severe.
So with that said, Jill, are more medical professionals getting away from automatically the answer being for a woman who is going through perimenopause, menopause, having these symptoms, a hysterectomy? I ask that question because that's what my mom did. Almost all of my girlfriend's moms all got hysterectomies. I mean, that's what they did 20, 30, 40 years ago. And now, you know, I'm in this position now where I am like, I'll deal with everything to keep my uterus intact. And I have a very good menopause specialist who is on board with that. So is that idea changing within the medical field? Like it's not, there are times when it is necessary that you must have things surgically removed, but that was not my mother's case, for example.
Yeah, I think we are seeing, I mean, I see that a lot. Older women will say, I had a hysterectomy, and sometimes, you know, it's not even clear for what indication because it was so common years and years ago. And I think a lot of times women will have a hysterectomy and keep their ovaries. And so mm-hmm. it can be actually kind of baffling for women when they come in at, let's say they had a hysterectomy at age 45, they kept their ovaries and they felt they didn't really think about menopause. And then at around 52 or 53, they're coming in and they're like, something's not right. I feel like something's really wrong with me. And then, you know, we kind of look at, okay, well, what's your hormonal status? Oh, you're menopausal now. And they didn't really anticipate that because they weren't having bleeding, you know, but women don't always realize that if you still have your ovaries, you're still cycling, even if you're not bleeding. And so, yeah, I don't know if Talia or Paro, if you want to chime in on that, if you think it's less common to do hysterectomies now, I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I mean, so definitely we are seeing a shift in that, you know, where you're absolutely correct. You know, our mother's generation, many women did have a hysterectomy for multiple reasons. Most times it was for heavy bleeding. And I think that the thought process back then was that, well, you don't need your ovaries. They're just going to turn into cancer anyway. And let's go ahead and take them out. And what we know is, especially for those women who were not, you know, postmenopausal, they went into mm-hmm. instant menopause and had, you know, terrible symptoms. But, you know, the paradigm is shifting in that even in postmenopausal women, if they require a hysterectomy, we really like to preserve the ovaries. And there's good reason for that. There's been really good data showing that the ovaries are still doing something even after menopause. We know that women who keep their ovaries actually have less mortality. They have less morbidity and they, you know, have less strokes, less dementia. So lots of great benefits for keeping the ovaries on board. Mm.
So Dr. Sobol, let's go back to mental health for a moment if we can, because I'd like to talk a little bit about, I think, some of the shame that is around perimenopause and menopause symptoms. I mean, it's a natural transition, right? I mean, as we said, half of Americans are going to go through this. If you were born with a uterus, you're going to go through menopause. And I know it's something that my girlfriends and I talk about a lot. I think we talk about it a lot because we're comfortable with each other. And I think it's also because our moms didn't talk about it. We don't necessarily always know our moms' experiences. And the only way that we're going to get rid of this shame and embarrassment around it is if we talk about it. But I mean, is that something that when women come into your office, that there is such shame and almost embarrassment around this?
I see that often. And unfortunately, I feel like what happens is, as you had said, right, there are certain women who feel comfortable talking about their body changes and what's happening. But for the majority of women who I see, this really isn't the case. They either may not necessarily have someone they feel safe talking to this about. Many doctors, because we don't get a lot of training in this, aren't the ones who are bringing it up or asking about it. So women feel like it's something they should suffer with in silence. And, you know, from our mother's generation, right, they don't often talk about this, or there's an encouragement of, oh, it's a natural process, just kind of get through it. And unfortunately, due to that, women come and they've either been suffering for several years. Wonderfully, sometimes we see women early on, but for many women, they come in and there's, you know, they've lost their fertility. They've lost this identity for who they've been told they should be as a woman, or who they really kind of have known about their bodies. And as we're talking about, there's so many changes, and there's fear associated with how their body's changing. Is this permanent? What's my future going to look like? And just, again, the timing is really hard, right? Women at the peak of their careers, they're caring for their loved ones, their family, their children. And this can just impact them in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm. And I'll be, you know, transparent here, right? It's one of these things. What I noticed is when I started going into having perimenopausal symptoms, I was so almost embarrassed, because, like, oh God, that means I'm old. Like, I'm old, right? Like, only old ladies go through this. And it was, I did, even though I had girlfriends to talk to, it was almost this, like, oh, this means that I am old, that I'm no longer viable, I think there's so much in our culture around how we view women, but in particular, you know, older women, which means you no longer, you know, you're in menopause. It's all of these things. Now, fast forward a couple of years, and I'm like, can we just get this done? I am so looking forward to when this is done. And so I'm wondering, Dr. Sobel, do you see a shift in women as well as they go through this process? I mean, does that make sense?
It definitely makes sense. You know, when I think about my patients and I think about who is coming in and, you know, distress versus relief versus like your exact words, Gemma, like, when will this be over? I'm done with this. I have women who are like, oh, I love it. I don't have a period anymore. But so many women are just frustrated by that loss of kind of their vitality, by how they identify themselves in terms of their partners and what it meant to have ovaries that were fully functioning. But I always like to give a little bit of a silver lining, right? And I always like to say, look, we're here, we're passionate about helping women. And this is a big transition. And women, again, are living almost half their lives in menopause, which didn't used to be the case. But there are small benefits, right? No longer having periods, and just really being able to own the fact that you've had this wonderful kind of reproductive years, but there's a lot of wonderful things to come after that too. And so every woman's very different in how they come to us, but I really appreciate your perspective.
Well, it's true. I'm like, let's move it on. Like, come on. So is there an ideal time that someone should start looking into beginning hormone replacement therapy?
I'm so glad that you brought that up, Gemma. Yes, there is an appropriate time to start hormone therapy. We call it the window of when we can start hormones. And this was nicely outlined in the latest guidelines from the North American Menopause Society. They came out with a position statement last year, just really outlining this. And what we know is that if women begin hormone therapy younger than age 60 or 10 years within the onset of their menopause, that the benefits generally outweigh the risks. And specifically, we're talking about cardiovascular risk and stroke risk, because that was the other big information that came out of the Women's Health Initiative. The Women's Health Initiative, like I said, that was done almost two decades ago, you know, we saw that these women were having increased risks of heart attacks and strokes. But we now understand that the average aged woman who is enrolled in that study was actually 60 or older. So really, you know, that data really did not apply to most of the women who are symptomatic, right? So the women who are in their early 50s coming in with hot flashes and night sweats. And subsequent to that, there have been some really good studies, including the KEEPS data, the SWAN data, looking at hormone therapy in that age group. And what has come from that is that there is an appropriate time. And so what I tell patients, and this is the message that I want to tell people, is that if you're symptomatic and you feel that you need treatment, go see your provider. Don't wait. You know, they can talk to you about the risks and benefits of hormone therapy, see if it's the right choice for you. But then, you know, if it isn't, or if hormones are not for you, then there are so many other non-hormonal options that still help the symptoms of menopause.
Mm-hmm. And can I quickly have you clarify something? Because I know I just get confused on this. So you said under the age of 60 or within that 10 years of menopause, of the onset of menopause. So the onset of menopause, does that mean when your periods stop?
Right. So the definition of menopause is no period for a year. It's a retrospective diagnosis. So usually people are like, oh yeah, you know, last April was when I had my last period. So usually that's when I say, okay, how old were you a year ago when you last had your period? And I kind of use that as my starting point. So I do have, so, you know, 51 is average, right? So there are women who are younger, women who are older. So say if you have a woman who is 55 when she goes into menopause and she sees you at age 60, I would say that she's still within that window, especially when we look at her entire health history and we weigh the risks and benefits. If we find that the benefits are outweighing the risks, I would definitely start that patient on hormone therapy.
Okay. So we're going to turn now to sexual health. I know this can be embarrassing, it can be shameful, but it is so necessary to be talking about. So Dr. Sobel, what are some of the symptoms that women start experiencing during this time of life?
The most common symptoms that we hear when women come to see us are a change in libido, oftentimes can be a drastic drop in libido and desire, and often a change in kind of the quality of sexual activity. And by that, I mean dryness, pain with sex, and just a really big change in how sex feels or how much they want to have sex compared to just typically a few years prior.
Okay, so then what type of management options are there for women? But also, we should say that these symptoms are normal if a woman is experiencing this, and bring this up in your conversation with your medical provider.
And I very much respect that this is taboo. And, you know, it's one of my favorite things to talk to women about, because sexual health is health, right? This is a very important topic for women. And I always would encourage every woman listening, if this is something that's happening to you and you are distressed by it, please talk to your provider, because there are absolutely things we can do. So when I typically talk to a woman or patient about low desire, change in libido, I think about it from a biopsychosocial approach. So what does that mean? That means I really look at the person sitting in front of me, and I think about four different aspects of what might be impacting their libido. The first thing I think about are biological causes, right? Do they have any health conditions that can impact their libido? Are they on medications that can lower libido? Hormone loss and menopause, you know, that loss of testosterone and change in hormone levels can as well. And fatigue, which again, we've talked about a lot due to lack of sleep. And then I like to think about psychological parts, right? The mood changes, depression, anxiety, change in their self-image and how their body looks and feels, any history of substance use or trauma. And then we talk about their partner. Do they have a partner? Do they like their partner, right? Is there somebody in their life who they do want to have sex with? And then from a sociocultural perspective, and this is regarding shame surrounding sex, right? Did we get good sex education, if at all, right? What does it mean to be a sexual person after you can no longer have children?
Okay, so lots of good things to be discussing there when you go see this. I also want to talk about more about physical health. And as you mentioned, Dr. Sobel, sexual health is part of physical health. But Dr. David, cardiovascular disease is the biggest killer of women. And I know a lot of times there's this idea that it's breast cancer, but it's cardiovascular. So how does one have a more heart-healthy lifestyle during this time of life and beyond?
Right. So, you know, you're absolutely right. Cardiovascular disease is still the number one killer for women, and it's not breast cancer. So I think that that's another myth that patients have. And I think that it's, you know, so important during this time in a patient's life that, you know, we talk about what changes are happening with your body. You know, you need to be getting an adequate amount of sleep at night. You need to be getting an adequate amount of exercise. You know, are they eating a healthier diet, you know, getting more fiber, you know, things like that. Stress reduction, that's a huge one. So, you know, I have this conversation with my patients, you know, regarding cardiovascular health as well.
And Jill, can we add on to that? Because you had mentioned these things as well in your practice, and the importance of someone in this stage of life, you know, making sure that there are not just, you know, hormone treatments, right? I mean, of course, that's a part of the overall health for someone going through this. But it is, as Dr. David mentioned, you know, there are non-hormonal treatments that women should be thinking about as well right now, correct?
Sure. I think, you know, everything that Dr. David just mentioned, you know, I think also a lot of women will notice that sugar, unfortunately, sugar and alcohol and nicotine can be huge triggers for hot flashes and sleep disruption around menopause. And I think, you know, something as simple as, you know, adopting a low sugar diet and avoiding alcohol can really go a long way. And, you know, as far as non-hormonal treatments, you know, really you know, one of the biggest contraindications to hormone therapy is if you are actively being treated for breast cancer, or have a history of breast cancer. And so for women who have breast cancer, they may have also really severe menopause symptoms. And the next best non-hormonal options are antidepressants, like SSRIs. And then there's some other medications like gabapentin that will also reduce symptoms. What we do know, Gemma, is that those medications may be effective for mild to moderate symptoms, and that for severe symptoms, hormone therapy is vastly the most effective treatment. So it is the one that we spend probably the most time talking about. But I do really like to drive home those lifestyle choices for women, just so that we can all feel empowered, you know, to live our best lives, really.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. David, can we go back to exercise for a minute? Because I've been doing quite a bit of reading on this. I've always been one of these people that if I'm not sweating, I don't feel like it's exercise. And to realize that in this phase of my life, I really need to be doing, you know, I mean, of course, exercising, weight-bearing exercising, but with cardio, it's like I'm not running as much as I used to. I'm doing much more walking, hiking, but I want to say I'm being gentler with my body, and I feel like I am, I feel better. I feel like I'm healthier, but it's had to be a really big mind shift for me. And I'm assuming I am not the only woman in that situation.
You're right, Gemma. That is absolutely correct. So one of the things that happens with the loss of estrogen is that it affects our collagen. And so that affects our joints especially. And so this is why one of the biggest symptoms that patients will come in with is that they'll say they have joint pain. I have many women who will tell me they feel like they became old overnight, you know, and their joints are very creaky. But it's true, you know, your joints are not as well lubricated as they were before. Even if you go on hormone therapy, you know, or estrogen, it's not going to be like what it was like previously. The other thing that happens is that there is this shift in metabolism that happens, you know, to everyone as we get older. You know, there is a shift in body fat, meaning that it becomes more centrally located. And so one of the things that I tell patients is that we now know that, you know, doing cardio until you just pass out is not recommended anymore. In fact, doing up to 150 minutes of cardio per week is adequate. And that's probably a relief for a lot of patients, you know, or a lot of people, because, you know, that means that you don't have to be out there running for hours and hours. You know, even if you do 30 minutes three times a week, that's plenty. And you don't have to do it that way. You could divide it up any which way you want. And then I do tell patients that doing some strength training is going to be really important, because one of the things that happens when we lose our hormones is that our muscle mass decreases significantly, which increases fat weight on our body. So we need to keep up that metabolism by doing strength training, by keeping your muscles active, and then you end up burning calories even when you're not exercising. So those are some of the tips that I give patients surrounding exercise.
I want to finish our conversation. I only have about 5 minutes left with advice on how to advocate for yourself in order to get the help and the treatment that you really deserve. So Jill, walk us through some of the things that a person should do. And maybe the first thing is find a menopause specialist.
Yes. So as we've kind of touched upon, there's, you know, not every provider may feel confident talking about menopause and or sexual concerns. And so I think, you know, going to menopause.org is the North American Menopause Society's website. They have a great find a provider page. So look for a specialist in your area or someone who's just listed on their website as being menopause informed. There's another great website that focuses on female sexual health. That's prosela.org. And that's another great resource. I always recommend if women can track their symptoms, there's menopause symptom questionnaires online, and you can kind of look at, you know, go in prepared a little bit with what has been bothering you the most. And also really requesting a longer appointment time if you're going to go and see your general practitioner and see if they can speak to you about menopause. You know, being prepared to go back for a second visit if you're the type of person who needs to think things over in between. So really just making sure that you're getting going in prepared, and, you know, asking for that longer appointment time can be really helpful.
Mm-hmm. And Jill, that was the thing that really stuck out to me was, you know, ask for a second appointment, right? If you need to absorb all of this information, you may not want to make a hasty decision. So that's critically important to, you know, and that comes back to advocacy for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, you know, becoming your own advocate. I think that really starts with, you know, the social aspect, for a lot of women, just understanding you're not alone. There's a really great podcast by Dr. Kelly Casperson called You Are Not Broken. Her podcast is for menopausal women. It's amazing. She's a urologist. She talks a lot about sexual health and different treatments. It's very patient friendly. There's also a local organization here, the Idaho Sexual Health Professionals. And we're actually having a conference on May 19th in Meridian. So if you're a professional in the helping professions or in the medical field and want to learn more about menopause, that could be a great opportunity as well. I can also share another book called Come As You Are, mm-hmm. which is a really popular book about sexual health that is amazing. And The Menopause Manifesto is another popular book. So I think just looking, you know, who in your community is talking about this, and just really starting the conversation with yourself is the first step.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you for taking this hour to talk with us. I think it's just such a necessary conversation to be having, especially since if we can break down some stigma and some taboos around menopause. So thank you so much. All of you, thank you for your expertise and for your time. It is so greatly appreciated.
Thank you so much, Gemma.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Jill Gustafson, a certified nurse midwife and menopause specialist. She has a private practice here in Idaho. It's called Quantum Women's Health. Dr. Paru David, an internist and women's health specialist at Mayo Clinic in Arizona. She is a menopause certified practitioner by the North American Menopause Society, as well as Dr. Tally Sobel, a women's health internist at Mayo Clinic in Arizona. She, too, is a certified menopause practitioner by the North American Menopause Society. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
What if the greatest tragedy of your life was just covered up?
I have never seen anything like that before or after.
This is the story of the worst marine on marine friendly fire in modern history, a story kept from the public.
It's like, what did y'all have to hide?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast in its latest series, Taking Cover.